Hey, this is Greg Vandermeer. I'm the lead pastor at Fairhaven Church. Welcome to our weekly podcast. Fairhaven is part of Harbor Churches, a multi-site church located in West Michigan. We exist to help people find their way back to God. We hope this message helps you take your next step in your faith journey. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Fairhaven. My name's Jeremy. I'm one of the pastors here. How are we doing this weekend? Good weekend so far? Fourth of July weekend. We actually spent this past week, my family and I, up at my in-laws have a cottage about an hour or so up north. And so we were able to spend a bunch of time there. It was great. And then I had this two days ago, I was like chewing on a peanut M because like that's all I do at the cottage is like spend some time on the water and eat snacks, apparently. So diet starts tomorrow. But I'm chewing on a peanut M&M and realized one of them was crunchier than it should have been. And then you know that moment when like a couple moments later, like, oh, there's a weird jagged spot where a piece of tooth used to be. So I looked at my wife, was like, apparently I'm to the age now where like my teeth are falling apart. But so outside of that, like it's been a great weekend. I just wish all of me came out of it. But now excited to be here this morning. We're continuing a series we started a handful of weeks ago called Asking for a Friend, where we've been looking at some kind of the big questions of faith, some big questions that you may have asked, some questions that you have friends that may have asked. And so we've been looking at things like last week, how do we deal with conflict, especially if we call ourselves followers of Jesus? How do we deal with those difficult moments in life? How do we deal with conflict? And then a couple weeks ago, we did like a two-week series on, I think, one of the big questions that has caused people over time to question faith, to question, what do I think of all of this? Do I buy it? Can I find myself in the faith? We looked at that question on the problem of evil. If God is good, why does evil exist? And all of those sermons, they're on our podcast, or on our YouTube channel, Vimeo. We would love for you to go back and look at those. But today, I want to look at what I think is another question that a number of us, myself included, have asked that is also, I think, one of those questions that has caused some people over time to ask whether or not they can buy it, whether they can buy faith, whether they can see themselves, whether they can be a part of the church, or if this question became so big that they just don't feel like they can be honest with themselves and say yes to the faith and be part of the church. Today, we want to ask the question. One way to ask it is, do I have to turn off my brain in order to be a question, or in order to be a Christian? But essentially, one of the questions I want to look at is around this idea of a debate between faith and science. So it's a debate between faith and science. How do these two things relate? Do they? If you say yes to faith, does that mean you have to say no to science? If you say yes to science, does that mean you have to turn your back on faith? How do these two things go together? Can they go together? Is science an enemy of faith? Is faith an enemy of science? Now, I can remember for me, the first time I started really asking this question, I can remember a few moments in my life when I look back. I remember a time specifically I was in, I believe it was middle school or early high school, and I remember sitting in a science class, and I remember my teacher at the beginning of the class saying, okay, what I'm about to teach you, I've got to teach you because it's in the curriculum, but I want to let you know that if you want to talk after class, I'd be more than happy to share what I actually think, because he said, in my faith, I don't actually necessarily think what I'm about to teach you, but I have to because it's in the curriculum. And I remember as a young kid in that moment realizing what he's about to share must be something bad, right? Must be something threatening to my very faith that for the first time, I had this idea that there was faith and there was science and maybe there is this giant debate that to say yes to one means no to some things of the other. And then I would go on and I would go to college. My college actually started, I didn't think this is what I was going to be doing with my life for a number of years out of college. I actually spent my first year and a half of college at Grand Valley thinking I was going to be a mechanical engineer. And so you find yourself in a bunch of science classes. And what I found is that I'm sitting in classes and I'm hearing things that sounded a lot like what some of my middle school, high school science professors would say or teachers would say. And there were moments where I'm like, I don't know that I can fundamentally say that that is not true. But I was told that if you think that's true, you can't be, how do I justify these things in my mind? I've had the opportunity to walk alongside a number of people over the years who have found themselves in a spot where they were told that in order to follow Jesus, you essentially have to turn a blind eye to a number of things, and then found themselves in that spot where they realize, okay, but what if there's truth in it? Do I have to pick one or the other? The number of times I've heard people talk about how, well, so-and-so, they left the church or they walked away from their faith because they got too smart or they were too intellectual that it didn't work for them anymore. Which then begs the question, is faith just for the simple-minded? Is faith for those of us who don't want to think really deeply about the big things, or is there a different way to hold these two things together? Do faith and science have to be enemies? Is there another way? And do you have to check your brain at the door? Because it doesn't make sense to me, especially when I look at when Jesus at one point in his life, he was asked, Jesus, what is the most important thing? What is the greatest commandment is the way they asked it. And Jesus responded by saying this. And they said, teacher, what's the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus says the greatest thing is, yes, you give me your heart, you give me your soul, and you give me your mind. One of the ways we can worship God is through our minds. For me, I feel like I have, like I said, through my life, I had struggled with these questions early on, especially because I like to call myself a more curious type. My wife would probably call me annoying, right? Because I'm the one who always wants to ask the big questions. I don't want to just accept just surface level answer, just think this because we told you this is true. I want to ask the big questions about why, about what's going on behind it. And so how do we do this with faith and science? I want to turn to some words from King David. King David, he wrote a number of our Psalms. Psalm 19, David says these words. So if you want to follow along, you can go to Psalm 19. We'll only be in kind of a handful of verses this morning, but you can jump there. Psalm 19, David says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. See, David recognized when he looked out at the world around him, what he saw is the heavens, the universe, the world that we live in, all together declares the goodness of the glory of God, even though David said, the creation, the world around us does not have words. And yet, when we look at it, what we find is that it is covered in the fingerprints of the one who created it, is covered in the fingerprints of God, that the universe declares the goodness of God. So David has this idea that all of creation should point us directly at God. And I think David's idea of how this works, I think it I think it's really helpful in the face of the way I can sometimes see the way faith and science gets reconciled in so many conversations. There's an idea that we've actually talked about it on this stage before, but I think it's really important to the conversation. And so I want to share it again. It's this theory, this idea that we call the God of the gaps. That often one of the ways people try to reconcile faith and science and how these two things are related is in this idea of the God of the gaps. So what does God of the gaps mean? Well, essentially, if we put the next slide up, if we put a graph up between 0 and 100, let's use this graph as a way of thinking about how much we understand of a certain topic. Okay, 0 is we don't know anything. 100 is we pretty much have it nailed. We fully understand it. We know everything. And I get the graph is already kind of broken because there's really nothing we really know all of, right? But if the graph represents 0, we know nothing. 100, we know everything. The reality is on so many things, we find our what we know, what we can understand, what we can observe to be somewhere in between. So next slide. Let's pretend and fill in the blank on whatever topic we want this to be. This is our understanding of the way light moves through the universe, okay? Let's just throw something out there. So if we understand, if we can observe, we can research, we can study, we can see about half of it. There's a bunch that we understand, but then we recognize there's a point at which our understanding stops, and what's left, we just don't understand how this piece works. We get this, we can describe this, but this we don't quite understand. A God of the gaps is a way of reconciling faith and science where we would then say, that extra bit that we don't understand, that we attribute then to God. So we can explain this. It's cause and effect. These things happen. But once we get to the end of our knowledge, what's left, we say, okay, that we will ascribe to God. God is responsible for that. You see the problem in this way of thinking, right? Because what happens a few years later? Somebody comes up with a brand new technology. We have a breakthrough, we're able to see something, to observe something, to study something that we've not been able to before. And so what happens is the level of our understanding, how much we know about the topic, gets bigger, which then does what to that gap we give to God? Continues to get smaller. So now we can explain all of this. That little bit that we don't quite yet, that we say, that will give to God. And then, again, a few years later, we have a new breakthrough. Somebody discovers something. A new technology allows us to see something we've not seen before. And what happens is that line of our knowledge keeps getting bigger, and that gap that we ascribe to God keeps getting smaller until we ultimately kind of, in a lot of ways, end up squeezing God out altogether. This is the God of the gaps. We can describe, and then that leftover we ascribe to God. What I don't see in this, what I don't see in David and his understanding of the world that he was living in, is this. What I see of David, if I make a really ugly graph, just to use my line chart, if we go to the next one, if I stretch the word way too big, essentially what David says is, no, 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 what we don't find is just God in the gaps that we don't know. What we find is God's in all of it. That instead of just describing that little bit of the gap at the end to God, what if the things that we understand point as much to God as the mystery of the little bit, whatever size gap that is that we don't quite yet, what if we use the whole thing? What if the whole thing declares the goodness of the glory of God? What if the heavens do, in fact, declare the goodness of the glory of God, and we are able to see it in all of it? Paul is one of the first church missionaries. He's one of the first church planters. Paul would write a number of letters to a number of churches. And Paul would actually, he would write a letter to a church in Colossae. Colossae was a little unique to Paul because most of the letters Paul sent out were to churches that he had planted or churches that he had at least visited. Colossae was a little bit different. Colossae was a church that he did not plant, he had not visited, but Paul had heard that there were some kind of cultural, societal pressures that were pushing the members of the church in Colossae to potentially walk away from the faith. And Paul writes to address it. And one of the things Paul says in the book of Colossians, in the letter to the church in Colossae, he says, the Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all of creation. For in him, all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things, Paul says, have been created through him and for him. Paul sounds a lot like David, doesn't he? All things that exist, everything that exists, was created by Christ and for Christ. And then Paul says this in that next line. He says, he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. See, Paul had this cosmology, this understanding of science, of nature, of the way the world works, that all of it was created through Christ, and all of it is held together by the person of Christ, by the God who created all of it. What I find fascinating is the way the early followers of Jesus saw the way this play out and even responded to some of the ways, some of their major thinkers during their day. Let me introduce you to a guy. This is a guy by the name of Heraclitus. Say hi, Heraclitus, all the kids, right? All right. Heraclitus was a Greek philosopher that lived about 6 BC. And Heraclitus, he's really well known for a statement. He had kind of a line that, anybody know of Heraclitus? Oh, yeah, oh, well done. All right, we got a couple to know Heraclitus. So Heraclitus is really well known for this sentence. He says, no one can step in the same river twice. It is impossible, Heraclitus says, for you to step into the same river twice. Why? Well, Heraclitus being a philosopher's, we can call them curious or annoying, right? They ask all the really big questions. Heraclitus recognized that if there's a river, right, there's a river flowing by. Anybody ever step into a river? Yeah, of course, every hand should go up. You've all stepped into a river. So Heraclitus recognized if you step into a river and then you step out of the river, what he recognized is the water that you stepped into is no longer in the place you stepped into it. Right, that water is now down here, and it's moving about, and it's doing all kinds of things. And so he recognized the river is always moving. Heraclitus, being the philosopher, also realizes that you are always changing. That even the thoughts that you had, that you step in, you step out, the thoughts you have are different. The way you would step into it is different. We actually know now from what we've been able to observe between the time of Heraclitus and today that our bodies are constantly changing. That every moment, literally every moment of every day, you have cells that are dying and flaking off you, which makes you question the fabrics you're sitting on and touching, right? But you have cells that are dying and falling off, and then your body is essentially always recreating cells. We actually know, and on this, my little disclaimer, I probably should have said a lot earlier, I'm not an expert scientist. I geek out on a lot of this stuff, so I'm gonna say some things wrong and use some wrong words. But what I understand that we've studied at least is that your body will essentially completely recreate itself about every 7 to 10 years, that your cells will die and they will be replaced by newer cells. Which means if you show up at your 10-year reunion, right, everybody there is they're the same people, but they're also kind of not, right? They're kind of also brand new, right? That's crazy. But so we know that our bodies are constantly changing. And so if you walk into the river, not only has the river changed in the amount of time it takes you to step back in, but you are kind of a different person, even maybe just moments after you first stepped into the river. So Heraclitus recognized that all of life is changing. everything is changing. There is a rapid just movement and change in everything. But Heraclitus was asked then, okay, but how does the whole thing not just fall into disorder? How does the, if everything is constantly changing, how does the whole thing not just fall into chaos and disorder? Well, Heraclitus says, well, there is something that actually holds all of it together. That thing Heraclitus said holds everything together is a Greek word. It's a word we know as the logos. John, one of Jesus' closest disciples, the one Jesus loved, one of Jesus' 12, John would write a gospel telling about the story of Jesus, and John would start it this way. He would say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And we know in this, John is using the word Word as a way of talking about Jesus. He's referring to Jesus, but the very word that John uses for Word, any guesses what it is? Logos. John says, in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was God, and the Logos was with God. John says, yes, there is something that holds everything together. One that through whom everything was made, one that apart from him, nothing would continue to be. There is someone or something that holds all of it together, and that is the very one who created it. We no longer necessarily buy the way of Heraclitus, but maybe we do. I guess rivers are constantly changing. But I want to bring you to the modern day understanding of the atom. If we go to the next picture, the atom. Kids, how many of you have studied atoms in school? Yeah, atoms. For a long time, we believed that the atom was actually like the smallest piece of matter that we could study. Since then, shocking, new technology has developed. We've now been able to recognize subatomic particles. But the atom, for a long time, we believed was the smallest building block, okay? So an atom is made up of your nucleus, the protons and neutrons in that little ball in the middle, and then you have electrons that travel in an orbit around the nucleus. We all kind of remember how an atom works? The interesting thing with an atom, first, just size. Atoms are so small. Get this. There are apparently more atoms in this cup of water than there would be cups of water in all of the oceans on the earth combined. Let me say that again. There are more atoms in this than there are cups of water in all of the oceans combined. They are tiny. What we know is atoms, you have the protons and neutrons and electrons, but if you, essentially an atom is 99.9 repeated percent space. Right? Because the protons and the neutrons and the electrons are so small that it is 99% of it is just empty space. You are made up of atoms. We know that if atoms are 99.999 repeated percent empty space, what are you 99.9% of? Essentially just empty space. So if somebody ever like says you're full of hot air, they might not be wrong, right? Like it's really a question of like whether you consider 98.6 degrees hot or lukewarm, because you know, lukewarm air might be the best way to describe it. But 99.9% space, they actually say that if you could remove the space from all of the atoms that make up every human that exists, and all you have left are the protons, neutrons, and electrons, you remove all the empty space and you bring all of the pieces of atoms together of every person that exists, they say it would be smaller than a sugar cube. And yet, there's an order to it. And yet, there's a design to all of it that even as we research, as we study, as we see more and more about how it all works, there's an order to all of it. Your atoms do not just spill out into nothingness. There is something, there is a force, there is something that holds it all together. There's a design, there's an intentionality, there is an order to everything that exists. It's almost like Paul was right when he says the words to the Colossian church, that in him all things hold together. That we find an order in all of it, which shouldn't surprise us, because that's literally the way our Bible starts, right? If you were with us year and a half ago, we spent a good chunk of a year working through the book of Genesis. And Genesis, you probably know the words, whether you grew up in the church or not. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If you weren't with us through the Genesis series, you should at least go back to the first few sermons of the Genesis series, because we really talked about that, about the way God created the world, about how when God created, what we find is this intention, we find design, we find order in all of it, that it shouldn't surprise us that as we continue to discover, as we continue to learn, what we continue to find is design and order in everything. That maybe David was right, that science isn't the enemy of faith, but maybe as we study, maybe we do continue to find time and again that the heavens do in fact declare the glory of God. And maybe what we find when we look into it is that maybe what we find is that the question of what they're trying to achieve might be a little bit different. That what we find is, in a lot of cases, science is trying to answer the question to how. Right? How does it work? Why does it work the way it does? How does it work? And what religion, what our scriptures are trying to do is tell us why it matters. Why did God create the world that he did? Why did God create you and me and humanity to populate the world that he did? Science can help us understand how it all works. What our scriptures do is they tell us why it even happened in the first place. They teach us a why and they teach us a who, something about who the person of God is, that God is the one who authored all of it, that part of why it's ordered is because we worship a God of order, of design, of infinite creativity, that maybe the heavens do in fact declare the glory of the goodness of God. And so I would say, one thing I would say is that, let's put the next slide up. I would say the difference between the two, or similarities between the two, I would say faith should always go beyond the evidence, but it shouldn't go against it. That faith should always go beyond, but it shouldn't go against. And then I want to show you a quote from Albert Einstein. Do you know how hard it is to find like a relatively respectable looking picture of Albert Einstein? There's like, he either looks like he just got electrocuted, or there's that weird picture with his tongue out and he kind of looks like he's trying out for the band Kiss. If you don't know the picture, Google Albert Einstein and it's crazy. So Albert Einstein said, "Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind." Einstein recognized that faith should not have to turn its back on, but should always go beyond and ask the bigger questions of why and what does it teach us about God, about who God is, about who we are. Let me give you a couple examples. Between the God of the gaps, between science is bad, and between a David understanding of the heavens do declare the glory of God, This, I believe, is a lima bean plant. My daughter planted this in school, so they're still up at the cottage. So, Larkin, thank you for letting me use your plant. And forgive me for it looks really rough, right? Can we name that it looks really rough? This lima bean plant, we've been gone for a week, so it's thirsty. I did water it a little bit today, but it's still, tell you what, there you go. So, my daughter, a few months ago in class, they were learning about the way plants work. And so they talked about how if you take a seed and you take soil and you make sure the soil has the right nutrients present, so you put the right fertilizer in it, you put said seed in the soil, you then apply water, you apply sunlight, you can watch it turn from a seed into like that little kind of seedling into a full-grown plant that apparently, I think it's starting some lima beans right there. But what we can do, what we could do is we could look at this as just a random chain of cause and effects, right? You put the seed in soil, you add water, you add sunlight, cause, effect, this is the result. Or we can step back and go, isn't it amazing that God created such an orderly world that we can study, we can research, we can know how it works, because we can know how it works because we have a God who created it all in with an order that we can do something and know what's going to happen, because that's literally how the system works. And we can stand in awe of the God who created all of it, and even to an extent remind ourselves of what God first called Adam and Eve and those first family in the garden, when he called them to be co-creators in the world that he's created. We can view the world as just a mechanistic, random cause and effect, or be reminded of the goodness of God that exists in all of it. Next picture. Ultrasound, right? There are kids in the room, so we won't talk about how, but what we know is we know that we can study, and we know that there are steps to how a baby is formed, right? We can name a number of steps. We teach it in school. You can describe it. And yet, when you're holding a newborn baby in your arms, what you don't do is look down and go, oh, that's a precious little result of like random cause and effect, right? What you find is this unbelievable new life squirming in your arms that, yes, we can study and we can come to know some things about the process, but then we go beyond the process as it points us to the goodness of the glory of the God who created all of it and makes all of it possible. So may we be people who, like David, have our eyes open to all of it, recognizing that the world we live in, like David recognized, is not just a random chain of cause and effect, but the world we live in is constantly speaking, even though it does not have words, because it is infused, it is covered by the very fingerprints of the one who created it, that all things in all of creation continue to proclaim the goodness of the glory of God. And so may we be people who continue to have eyes open to see it, to stand in awe and wonder at the bigness and the greatness and the glory of the one who created all of it. Would you pray with me? God, we thank you for this, the world that you've created and placed us into, for the call that you have put on us to be co-creators with you, to joining you in the work that you are doing in this, your world, to bring goodness, to bring kindness, to bring love, to bring more of you into every relationship we have, into every person we meet, into everything we do. God, may we be faithful. May we be faithful, and may you work through us and your church to continue to build your kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening. Our hope is that you were able to catch a glimpse of Jesus as seen in the scripture, and it'll help you as you live a life modeled after his. For service times or for more information about how to be a part of Fairhaven, you can visit us at fhchurch.org. Have a great week.